Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to The Lead. I'm Jake Tapper, and we begin with breaking news moments ago. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases globally surpassed 1 million. And there are 51,000 deaths worldwide. Here in the United States, there are a confirmed 236,000 cases and 5,648 deaths at this hour. This as we learn of a new projection that 94,000 people may die in the United States by August of the coronavirus. And scientific experts have now informed the White House that research suggests that coronavirus can also be spread from someone infected, not just by that individual sneezing or coughing, but also by that individual merely speaking or maybe even just by breathing. There have been discussions inside the Trump administration over whether to tell the general public to wear masks. And now Los Angeles is advising its residents to wear non-medical grade masks or face coverings. Obviously, this poses its own new challenges given the supply shortages still plaguing hospitals across the nation for surgical masks, N95 masks, other personal protective equipment, and, of course, ventilators, to say nothing of the continued lag in testing kits for a country the size of the U.S. And healthcare workers are sounding the alarm.
Every day when I go to work, I feel like a sheep going to slaughter. We are dying. We are getting sick. It doesn't matter how many ventilators we get. If we are dead and cannot run the ventilators.
Among those lost so far, an ER doctor who survived cancer twice and a 7-week-old baby in Connecticut. And officials in states across the country are warning they cannot be certain when the apex of the virus will hit. As CNN's Erica Hill now reports from the U.S. epicenter, New York.
More than 90% of the country today ordered to stay home. But an exemption in some states for religious services is raising concern among experts and some faith leaders.
We love our city. We love the people here. The last thing we would want to do is to put people in danger.
In Texas, one state lawmaker is sounding off. More than 40 students there have now tested positive after going on spring break.
Quit being an ass. Whether you think this is an issue or not, it is.
And there is new information about transmission. Experts telling the White House currently available research supports the possibility that coronavirus could be spread directly by patients' exhalation. In other words, it's not just sneezing or coughing, but simply talking or breathing. This, as the nation's second largest city tells people to wear masks.
But when you have to go out, we are recommending that we use non-medical grade masks or facial coverings and not take the ones that are reserved for our first responders.
Laredo, Texas, threatening residents with a $1,000 fine if they don't wear one in public. In New York, Mayor de Blasio says his city may run out of medical masks and other critical supplies by Sunday. Nurses there warning of dire consequences if they are not protected.
We are dying. We are getting sick. It doesn't matter how many ventilators we get if we are dead and cannot run the ventilators.
In Detroit, at least one hospital is already at capacity as the city's convention center is transformed into a temporary facility with 1,000 beds. In Boston, one of the New England Patriots planes arriving today with critical supplies from China. The Wall Street Journal reporting a dramatic scene. China giving them just 3 hours to land, load, and leave. And they took almost every minute.
Thanks to the generosity and hard work of the Kraft family and many other partners, Massachusetts will receive nearly 1,000,095 masks.
And new warnings from those closest to the disease.
I need everybody to know that this is serious. People think that it's just going to affect people with underlying health issues, old people, but it doesn't.
Nicole Buchanan's husband, Conrad, was just 39 when he died from coronavirus complications.
Jake, we're back here in Elmhurst in the Queensboro of Manhattan today. Elmhurst Hospital behind us. Now, we've been here on and off for the past week, a little over a week. And one of the things that we noticed today, Jake, is the line behind me has been growing. Over the last few days, we didn't see a lot of people in line in the afternoon waiting to get in. Today, at one point, at least 6 to 8 people in that line. They were spaced pretty far apart, wearing masks. And this is a public hospital, remember, in New York City. The group that runs these hospitals, New York City Health and Hospitals, the CEO of that group was talking to reporters about why there's such a concentration in Queens and pointed out while social distancing is happening in the city, many people, especially in this area, are living in close quarters, multiple families living together. And as we're learning more about the spread, Jake, it sort of puts all those pieces together.
Thanks, Erica. And joining me now is CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Sanjay, we've now learned that the coronavirus death toll modeling projection cited by the president and the task force has already revised upward. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised, Jake. You know, that there's this particular model, the one that's coming out of University of Washington, is the one that the White House has cited several times. You know, there's a couple things that, you know, I think are important to note about the model. First of all, to get to the numbers of deaths that they were projecting, you know, close to 100,000, that was predicated on the fact that the social distancing plan would be fully enforced in the country and last until May. And that was supposed to happen by tomorrow. I think given that that doesn't look like it's going to happen, some more states are putting these stay-at-home orders, but not enough, Jake. And I think that that's revised the model upwards. And it's also, as you know, based on the fact, like, do we have enough surge capacity in these hospitals? Some hospitals are doing a good job. The modeling predicts that some are not. And so the numbers will continue to get revised, I think, upward, Jake, until some of those things are met.
Sanjay, the FDA issued emergency authorization for an antibody test known as a serology test. Explain to our viewers what that means and how significant that could be.
I think this could be very significant, and this could be very welcome news, Jake. Basically, what this test is, it's a simple test. It's a strip. It has some virus on it. They take some of your blood. They put it on the strip. If your blood has antibodies on it, it's going to react to that virus and it changes color. And you basically know at that point that you have antibodies in your blood. And what it means if you have antibodies is that you were exposed to the virus. You were infected. Even if you had no symptoms, it means that you've already been exposed to the virus. That tells you a couple things. First of all, that, you know, it gives us some idea of how widespread this is. But also, Jake, I think more importantly, then you probably have some immunity to this. You know, you can have a little bit more confidence that you're not going to get reinfected, at least not soon. We don't know how long the immunity lasts, but at least you have some immunity to it. So I think it's potentially a big deal. It's a simple test if it can be made widely available. If it could be made widely available, Jake, and I wasn't taking it from somebody who needed it more, I would get the test done.
And Sanjay, a group of prominent scientists has informed the White House that the coronavirus can be spread by a carrier not just coughing or sneezing in somebody else's presence, but maybe even just speaking or breathing in somebody else's presence. That seems a tremendously significant development.
Yeah, no question. And my colleague Elizabeth Cohen was reporting on this. She obtained a letter that was sent to the White House about this. Look, you know, in some ways, Jake, this was not that surprising, I think, to a lot of scientists, because we have known that there is asymptomatic spread. Asymptomatic spread, which I think people may generally know what that means, but it means you don't have any symptoms like coughing or sneezing, and yet you're still spreading the virus. So how are you spreading the virus? You're spreading it through your breath. You're spreading it, you know, by talking, doing the things that I'm doing right now. I have no symptoms, but if I had the virus, that could spread it, you know, to a certain distance away from me. So it's now been sort of more, you know, recognized, I think, and described, you know, by these scientists. But, you know, we've had a general idea that this was happening already for some time.
Does it change the way we fight the virus in any way?
I think that, you know, one of the big things is that if you start to assume that, look, you can spread the virus and have no symptoms, okay, if you just sort of conceptualize that in your own mind, then that means that, for example, this big issue of masks when you're out in public becomes, you know, something that I think is worth considering, like you and I've talked about. It sounds very simple. I mean, it shouldn't take away, obviously, from hospital workers. Those aren't those kinds of masks. But I'm talking about masks that you wear when you go into public, not necessarily to protect yourself, but to protect other people. Why? Because if you have the virus, you wear one of these cloth masks, you might decrease the amount of virus that you're putting out into the environment. So that could be one way that I think, you know, you're already seeing this in Los Angeles. I believe the mayor has recommended people wear masks if they have to go out in public. Mm-hmm. Most people should stay home. But I think you may see that more widely adopted, Jake.
Right now, more than 90% of the American people are right now or will be soon under some form of stay-at-home order. A lot of states, for instance, Florida, which was, to be frank, kind of late to the stay-at-home order table, as you and I have discussed, are providing religious exemptions, meaning stay-at-home, but it's okay to go to your local church, synagogue, mosque, whatever. Medically, I'm a person of faith. I understand and believe in religion. But medically, does that concern you?
Well, yes. You know, look, I'm like you, Jake. I mean, I think maybe for some people, for a lot of us, faith has never been more important. I mean, you know, we need people to rely on and things to believe in when something like this is happening, no question. But Jake, I mean, this is scientifically completely goes against the evidence here. That type of gathering, unfortunately, it's very difficult to socially distance. We know the virus can spread like this, and we know people can then take it home to their families, to their communities. I mean, you know, it could be considered, despite that it's a religious occasion, a religious gathering, it's still very selfish if you go ahead and you infect other people as a result of this. So, you know, I know that the scientific knowledge is out there. I think people sort of get this at this point, that would be not just a danger to themselves, but maybe to the people they love as well. So if you're not doing this for yourself, at least do it for other people. So, Jake, as you know as well, there's technology. You know, you hear about all these religious organizations through technology, Skype and things like that, and streaming can still allow, you know, people to gather virtually. But scientifically, it just doesn't make sense, not sound.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta, thank you so much. I'll see you tomorrow. And you can see Sanjay tonight, along with Anderson Cooper, hosting the CNN Global Town Hall, Coronavirus, Facts and Fears. Their guests this evening will include Dr. Anthony Fauci, as well as New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. That's right here on CNN, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Coming up, a job market decline hardly any American alive has ever seen, and a new report just out that predicts more economic catastrophe. Plus, why infected patients seem to be getting sicker in one area of the country. Stay with us. New unemployment numbers out today are unlike anything this country has ever seen. 6.6 million people filed for unemployment last week alone. And when you add in the 3.3 million from the week before that, that's about 6% of America's workforce that has been out of a job and is applying for unemployment right now. A new dire economic forecast from the Congressional Budget Office this afternoon projected things could be bad for quite some time, estimates showing that in the second quarter, the unemployment rate could even exceed 10% and could still be at 9% at the end of next year, 2021, the end of 2021. Let's bring in CNN business anchor Julia Chatterley. And Julia, state unemployment websites are crashing. People are complaining, endless hold times when they call. Some governors admit they cannot keep up with the demand for unemployment compensation. So then what? What are people supposed to do?
Keep trying, Jake. There's simply no other choice. You just said it there in the numbers. We're talking 10 million people in the space of 2 weeks trying to file for unemployment benefits. The websites, the unemployment offices, they simply weren't built for this volume of people calling up and trying to get access to benefits. It's overloading the system. In certain cases, it's thousands times what they're used to processing. And at the federal level and even at the state level, they're trying to hire people, but try doing that in a time of social distancing. The problem in the data as well is that we're just seeing the states that went down into lockdown first. accelerating in these claims. So the backlog is still to filter through. And the biggest problem here, it's just going to take weeks to get money to people.
And CNN's Manu Raju on that subject reports that it could take up to 20 weeks. That's almost 5 months for stimulus checks to be mailed to some Americans, not every, but to some. CNN's Allison Kosick is reporting that a website to help those who do not have direct deposit relationship with the government from through the IRS or whatever will not be ready anytime soon, that website. So the functions of government are not working in terms of the stimulus funds getting to the people immediately.
And this is the problem. Deal with the checks first. In the past, it's already taken an average of 2 months to get a check into somebody's hands. So we knew there was going to be a problem. I've spoken to you before about the fact that 60% of people that filed taxes last year actually gave their direct deposit information. So it's the other subset of people that qualify for checks that we're trying to get access to. If this website, and it's got to deal with a lot of volume, isn't up and running for what, another 6 weeks, plus 3 weeks to try and get the money into people's bank accounts, we're talking 2 months beyond the lockdown. Two words, financial crisis for the individuals involved.
And Julia, some banks are warning tomorrow is going to be utter chaos. Tomorrow is when small business owners can begin applying for these stimulus loans. Some lenders say they need clear rules on vetting borrowers and forgiving loans if small business owners keep employees on their payroll. There's questions about whether they have to apply in person or whether they can do it online. Are these issues going to be able to be ironed out fast enough for tomorrow's deadline?
Yeah, in 24 hours, Jake, absolutely not. Remember, the Small Business Association is now promising to give out 10 times the amount of loans that it made in the entire year in 2019. But this, for me, is not even a processing issue. When I saw and got my hands on a sample of the form, I was so excited. It's so simple. This is it. There's loads of check boxes, so simple to fill in. I was excited. Then I realized for lenders, it's too simple. They're worried about the fact that they're going to be giving out fraudulent loans. They're saying they need protection. So the bottom line is, Jake, we're not getting money to people and they've still got outgoings happening. Something's got to happen soon to fix this.
All right, Julia Chatterley, thank you so much. For those hoping for leadership and symbols and signals of unity from President Trump, today President Trump went on Twitter claiming that some states, hospitals and medical centers have a, quote, insatiable appetite for medical equipment. And he said that the, quote, complainers should have stocked up previously. The president is also claiming that 51 large cargo planes worth of medical supplies are coming in with supplies. CNN has found that only a portion of the medical supplies being flown from overseas by FEMA to the U.S., only a portion of them are being allotted to critical hotspots, while the rest are being put on the private market, as CNN's Caitlin Collins reports.
As governors across the nation have begged for medical equipment, President Trump says some of them are complainers who have insatiable appetites for supplies. Trump tweeting today that the federal government is only a backup for states and that the complainers should have been stocked up and ready long before this crisis hit. But governors say the federal government is now competing with them to buy those supplies, forcing them to bid against each other and FEMA.
And now FEMA is bidding on top of the 50. So FEMA is driving up the price.
Trump says the federal government will back states up if needed, but there are questions about how. He confirmed yesterday that the national stockpile of protective gear is running low.
It is, because we're sending it directly to hospitals.
CNN has learned that only a portion of medical supplies being purchased by FEMA and flown in from overseas is going directly to coronavirus hotspots in the U.S. Instead of states being the sole recipients of what's purchased by the government, a FEMA spokesperson said some supplies are also being sent to the private market, where states are, once again, competing for them.
No matter how much we get, they seem to use it up very quickly.
The White House says it's keeping 10,000 ventilators in the national stockpile, ready to be deployed for areas that are the hardest hit. But the New York Times reports there are thousands more ventilators still in storage, ones that can't be used because of a lapse in maintenance. The president has directed some private companies to speed up production of ventilators.
We're soon going to have more ventilators than we need.
But companies like General Motors have still not started making them and must retool their factories first. Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a new bipartisan committee with subpoena power that will oversee the administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Where there's money, there's also frequently mischief.
She ended her conference call with reporters with this guidance.
Don't forget, hydrate, wash your hands, pray, dance, as if no one is watching.
Now, Jake, those ventilators we talked about that are undergoing maintenance, an official familiar says they are committed to having them in use for the coronavirus response by the end of the month. And that comes as the president is once again invoking the Defense Production Act to six companies. So he says he can help facilitate the supply of materials so they can start getting those ventilators built on that private level from those private companies that we saw him use for the first time last week.
Caitlin Collins, thank you so much. Coming up, mourning the loss of a loved one, only to succumb to the deadly coronavirus yourself. Stay with us. The small rural community, now a national hotspot thanks to two sad events that triggered an ugly and tragic domino effect. A new coronavirus hotspot has emerged, not in a major city such as New York or Detroit, but in a rural county in southwest Georgia, which includes the small city of Albany, Georgia. State health officials say it likely all started with a funeral after a retired janitor died from a heart attack at the end of February, back when both President Trump and Georgia Governor Kemp were downplaying the risks of the virus. Mourners gathered, and they gathered closely together to pay their final respects. And as CNN's Diane Gallagher reports, that's when local residents say the domino effect started.
Emel Murray has endured a lot of pain over the past 30 days. Back on February 29th, hundreds of family and friends came to the small Georgia city of Albany to say goodbye to Andrew Mitchell, the man that she loved for the past 20 years. After several hours of crying and hugging each other, Murray started feeling sick.
That night, my mother went to bed. She had a fever. We didn't even know it at the time.
The 75-year-old was presumably one of the first in Albany to be exposed to the coronavirus. She was hospitalized, but not immediately tested. Other members of their family, their friends who attended the funeral, began to get sick, too. And since then, several have died.
I knew things that were living in the last days. I knew things were going to be bad. But until it hits you, you know, that's when you're really just like, wow, it's here and it's now.
A positive test on March 10th from a visitor who attended the funeral tipped the Phoebe Putney Health System off. At least 20 of the first patients to be diagnosed with coronavirus in Albany had attended one of two funerals in town. A second trip to the hospital confirmed Murray was one of them. From there, the cases jumped.
Two the first day, it was six the next day, it was eight the next day, and it just began to cascade from that point.
So far, more than 5,000 people have been infected with the virus in Georgia. 163 have died. Nearly a quarter of those are from the Albany area. As the virus rips through their rural community, for so many here, it's overwhelming.
With us being in a small city, we're not New York, but we are still impacted. And when you look at the percentages of our population that's impacted, I mean, that's still a significant number.
Scott Steiner, the CEO of Phoebe Putney Health Systems, which serves southwest Georgia, says they blew through 6 months worth of personal protective equipment in just 1 week.
We've got 4,500 warriors. That's what these people, they're flat out warriors that do this day in and day out. They put themselves at risk. They run into the fire when other people might run away from it.
Some of the hospital's office workers have now traded their computers for sewing machines, making mask covers, an attempt to extend the use to PPEs. But even still, Steiner says they only have enough right now for less than 2 weeks.
We have seen that curve go up. We have not seen it bend over yet.
The governor deployed the National Guard to set up additional intensive care units.
We have shipped necessary supplies and planned more shipments based on the needs of Phoebe Putney's system in the future.
As for Murray, she's back home now. But her daughter says, like many in this family and small community, the road to recovery will be long.
It's hard watching her suffer.
Yesterday, Governor Brian Kemp issued a statewide stay-at-home order that goes into effect tomorrow, but they've been dealing with this for weeks here in Albany. Jake, I asked that hospital CEO if he thought that they were turning a corner, if they'd seen the worst of it already, and he simply shook his head, Jake, looked down and told me no, they had not.
All right, Diane Gallagher reporting from Georgia. Thank you so much. We should note that Governor Kemp inexplicably said today that he did not know until the last 24 hours that sometimes some of the people carrying the virus were asymptomatic. That, of course, has been common knowledge and publicly discussed by many individuals, including Dr. Fauci, literally for months. Now, if you go south and west of Georgia, you'll hit Louisiana, which is reporting a major spike in coronavirus cases with more than 2,700 new cases today alone. Louisiana now has the second highest death rate in the country from coronavirus per capita, just behind New York State. Joining me now is Dr. Robert Hart. Dr. Hart is the Executive Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Ochsner Health, the largest health system in Louisiana. Dr. Hart, thanks for joining us. The state reported 2,726 new cases in just one day. How bad is it on the ground in Louisiana? How much worse do you expect it to get before it gets better?
Well, Jake, we are certainly seeing more and more cases day to day. I think the big jump that we saw today was due to somewhat of the backlog of the testing that we've talked about frequently. And we were able to get a lot of those tests in. So it did give us somewhat of a surprising spike, but one that we partially anticipated at some point. But it is a severe test for all of the health systems in the state and all the people. And I have to tell you, the way people have stepped up and responded to this, it's really been incredible to see. But we know it is going to continue to get worse. We've all seen the numbers. Our governor stay-at-home order in place about 10 days ago. And we know that takes about 2 weeks to see. And so we are hoping that we will see that have a nice effect on the number of cases. But currently, our hospitals continue to expand as we continue to take in these cases.
And Dr., New Orleans officials tell CNN that one of the reasons that they hypothesize, one of the reasons that it might be hitting so hard in your state is because the population just demographically has a higher rate of underlying health conditions. Do you agree? Does that affect your planning for what could be an influx of patients?
Yes, it certainly does affect our planning, because we know here in Louisiana that we do have some of the highest incidence of hypertension, underlying kidney disease, heart disease, lung disease. All of those go into the we do. And so we've had to really look hard at how we begin to set up more intensive care beds. We are constantly moving, taking some of our beds that used to be medical and surgical beds and converting those to intensive care beds, because we know that people are going to require more intensive care than perhaps other populations without the underlying disease.
Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said that in the last week, the number of coronavirus patients in hospitals have doubled in Louisiana, and the number of patients on ventilators have doubled. And he warned that the state could run out of ventilators as soon as next week. Is that true? Is it that dire? How soon could you be facing a moment where you actually have such a surge in patients you can't handle them all?
Right. So that's always in the back of our minds, and that's continues to drive our efforts to continue to get the ventilators in. We know that our ventilator usage is up over 100% from what would be considered normal prior to the coronavirus. Our ICUs, we've grown by probably 70% now, and we anticipate needing to grow those ICU beds by another 30% to take in all the patients. We do have shipments coming in all the ventilators, but it is a concern to know that at some point we may not have those options available to us. The good news is we have different types of ventilator that we can use based on the severity of the patient. So sometimes we have to use a step-down ventilator for a patient who may be continuing to improve and get better, so we can use the more intensive care ventilators on those of our sickest patients.
Dr. Robert Hart, thank you so much. God bless you and all the medical workers there in Louisiana. Hope you get and have everything you need.
Thank you. They're all working very hard. Appreciate it.
I know they are. We want to take a moment to remember just a few of the literally thousands of people in the United States who have lost their lives to this terrible virus. We'll start with Ben Luderer. He was a healthy 30-year-old teacher and baseball coach from New Jersey. His wife, who is also currently battling coronavirus, says this is how she wants him to be remembered.
Every single person, whether he knew you for 5 minutes or he knew you for, you know, his whole entire lifetime, he would give you the same respect and try to reach out and help you and make you laugh in any way possible. You know, that was just the type of selfless person that he was, always worrying about everybody else before himself.
Conrad Buchanan was a healthy 39-year-old DJ. His wife and daughter fought to get him tested for days. They were denied. His wife, Nicole, says by the time he was finally admitted to the hospital in Florida, he was immediately intubated, and then she never got to see him again. May their memories be a blessing. Our hearts go out to their families and friends today. Coming up, a look across the globe, where an ice rink is now a makeshift morgue, and one country is running out of room for the bodies. Stay with us. Now we have some breaking news for you now. The commander of the USS Theodore Roosevelt is expected to be relieved from duty, a defense official tells CNN. The commander, Captain Brett Crozier, warned in a memo to Navy leadership that more action was needed for the coronavirus outbreak on his ship. The commander is being removed, we're told, because it is suspected that he is the one who leaked that memo when he was pleading for help to save the lives of his sailors. The Navy aircraft carrier had almost 100 infected sailors on board. About 1,000 sailors have been evacuated from the ship and moved ashore to Guam, where the ship is currently in port. The Navy will no doubt face questions about why it is punishing somebody who is trying to save the lives of his sailors. In our world lead, a horrific scene out of Ecuador, bodies being left on the street because morgues are to capacity. In the UK, one town anticipating a similar situation, that town is turning an ice rink into what they hope will not be, but could be used as a makeshift morgue. And as most of the world is preparing to see the worst of this pandemic, some are looking to China as a window into their possible future. But as CNN's David Culver reports, there are mounting fears from officials all over the world that the numbers and information provided by the Chinese government simply cannot be trusted.
As the United States and the rest of the world locks down, China cautiously opening back up, easing travel restrictions. And next week, it will allow people to freely leave Wuhan, the birthplace of the pandemic, for the first time in more than 2 months. The World Health Organization has consistently praised China's handling.
They're rapidly finding these cases, rapidly containing them, using the principles that China employed.
President Donald Trump also applauding the Chinese efforts just a few weeks ago.
I know this. President Xi loves the people of China. He loves his country. And he's doing a very good job with a very, very tough situation.
But as numbers in the U.S. continue to rise, so does the skepticism over just how reliable China's numbers are and how transparent it's been with its data.
The reality is that we could have been better off if China had been more forthcoming.
Video shows Wuhan's grieving residents collecting the remains of their loved ones. Daishin, a leading Chinese business publication, claimed there were thousands more urns delivered than the official coronavirus death toll. But worth pointing out, 2 days after the lockdown, Wuhan officials halted all funeral services in the city of 11-plus million. So it is plausible the urns are also used for those who died from something other than coronavirus. But CNN's early reporting inside Wuhan back in January suggested the numbers were not adding up when compared with the stories from the front lines, in part because of something that now many countries are challenged with, a shortage of tests.
It's really difficult, you know, like, and it's really emotional for me.
Dora Jong told us it took 4 days for her uncle to get tested. The results also delayed.
I don't think it's because they really want to control the numbers, but I think it's more about the capacity.
Kyle Hui told us by phone his mother died in mid-January in Wuhan. She never had a nucleic acid test, he told us. Her cause of death was officially listed as severe pneumonia. But during her treatment, the doctor said it was very likely that she had coronavirus. And yet she was not a confirmed case and hence could not be counted. China says they first detected the virus on December 12th at this Wuhan seafood market. But they did not shut it down until January 1st. And during that three-week period, the people of Wuhan continued on with their normal lives as local government officials censored so-called rumors about the then mysterious illness and silenced whistleblowers like Dr. Li Wenliang, who tried to sound the alarm. He was reprimanded by police, later died from the virus, and now the Chinese government is hailing him a hero. The country's National Health Commission officially began releasing daily figures on January 21st, almost 6 weeks after the first detection. Within days, they had reported a total of 1,052 confirmed cases in Hubei province alone. But almost immediately, health experts at the University of Hong Kong challenged those figures, believing the real number to be 40 times that just in the city of Wuhan. One possible reason, China, in the early days, not allowing international experts in the country. For weeks, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said the CDC was ready to deploy, hoping to get a handle on the problem before it got out of control.
We are ready to go.
But a World Health Organization team did not land in China until February 10th. Again, almost 2 months after the first detection. And now, 2 months after that, experts still doubt China's official count.
The Chinese government data is definitely not transparent. The local government has incentive to underreport the cases to boost the appearance of their good performance. We really don't have the information and evidence needed to be more confident about the Chinese government's number.
It's a claim the Chinese government has repeatedly shot down.
The fact is that China has always been open, transparent, and responsible on informing the World Health Organization and the international community.
Now, the one number that the Chinese government has pushed out quite frequently is the recovery rate here, Jake. They're stressing that the vast majority of people who get this illness do survive. And just this week, after some pressure, health officials here began releasing data on asymptomatic cases. There's been a lot of push for that. And the new concern here, as lockdown restrictions ease, is that both people without symptoms and those infected coming in from other countries may expose others to the virus. And then we could see here a second wave of infections in the place where really it all began. Jake.
All right, David Culver. President Xi of China certainly has a lot of blood on his hands, and it's not just of his own people. Coming up, it's almost 5 o'clock Eastern, but some of you might already be breaking out the Merlot and getting ready to watch Tiger King over a cocktail or five. We're going to talk to a psychologist about how to cope in this new isolated life and how to know if your new daily ritual is becoming a problem. Stay with us. Some are calling her their Quarren Queen after this clip of celebrity chef Ina Garten getting ready for cocktail hour, a.k.a. any hour, went viral.
So just pour it right in. Oh, doesn't that look fabulous? Nice and cold. And lots of it.
Alcohol sales are booming right now with so many people staying in and trying to deal with all this anxiety. But where is the line between enjoying a drink, relaxing, and something more serious? To talk about this and other quarantine life problems is our clinical psychologist, Georgetown psychology professor, Andrea Bonnier, for our weekly session. Andrea, what are you telling your patients about drinking?
Yeah, it's really tough because if ever there were a time where people are more tempted to drink, even if they don't typically have a problem, it would be now. We're trapped at home. We're feeling lonely and both antsy and bored at the same time. And the alcohol might be one of the only things that's left in our cabinets right now. So I'm seeing a lot of clients who are struggling with this question of what is too much and where to draw the line. And the first thing that I work with them on is figuring out, are they trying to escape uncomfortable feelings? And if they are, might there be better and healthier ways to do that? Or are they just sort of loosening themselves up a little bit, taking a little bit of the edge off? Because I think there is a slippery slope there between taking the edge off versus developing a situation where your main coping mechanism is to try to numb the hard feelings. I mean, these feelings are tough. We're sad, we're scared, we might be angry, we might be stressed and very, very fearful. And so the more that we turn to alcohol to avoid those emotions, then the more that we teach ourselves that those emotions are scary and that we can't handle them. And that's where a problem really starts.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, but I also wonder, I mean, I don't know what it's like at your house, but we might be a little bit more lax with the screen time rules at the at Shea Tapper these days, just because the kids are going through such a tough time. We don't need to pretend that these are normal times, and obviously nobody should be abusing any drug or alcohol. Do you have a rule? Do you tell people, in terms of the loosening up as opposed to escaping their emotions part of it? I mean, do you say people you should only be drinking twice a week, or I mean, how do you gauge?
Yeah, it's hard to quantify exactly, but I think what's less important than the actual amount is the feelings afterwards. You know, a lot of times you kind of know when maybe you overdid it or when it's happening too much or when you feel worse afterwards because the problems that you were trying to escape and the specific worries that you had are now coming back in full force and you weren't able to do anything about them. So I think if there's one hard and fast rule, it's to observe yourself before and after. What are you running from? And then afterwards, did it help? You know, was it okay? I was able to breathe and relax with that glass of wine, and now I actually feel better armed to get through tomorrow. Or was it, oh, I drank too much. I feel gross and more scared than I did before I drank. So it's hard to quantify because no two people are alike.
So the homeschooling, remote education thing has been going on for a little while at our house and at your house and at the house of a lot of our viewers. It seems a little tougher this week than last week.
Yeah, I think that's what's setting in for a lot of parents and also just folks in general is that the first couple weeks, it felt like crisis management, right? We all said all hands on deck, let's get through the day. And there's a little bit of adrenaline in that that just keeps us going. I think what's so tough this week and what I'm seeing a lot of is that the uncertainty of the future is now starting to weigh pretty large. Like, okay, we sustained this for 2 weeks, but what do you mean? You know, there's going to be another maybe month of this or 2 months of this. And so I've seen in a lot of my clients that this week has been particularly hard because, you know, it's one thing to kind of put a Band-Aid on stuff and slap together a daily schedule. But now we're thinking about the long term and how can we actually put things into practice that we're going to be able to keep up for the indefinite future.
And I've been saying to my kids, and we're almost out of time, but I've been saying to my kids, you're right. This sucks. This is awful. Mm-hmm. It's unfair. You have every right to be upset about it, but we're going to get through it and we're going to maybe even be stronger at the end. Am I saying the right thing?
Absolutely. Because what you're doing is that you're teaching them that having feelings, difficult feelings and expressing feelings and reaching out about feelings are positive ways to deal with those difficult times. And that's such a great lesson to teach our kids. I think that's something that is positive that can emerge from this.
All right. Our session is over. I'll see you soon, Dr. Andrea Bonnier. Thank you so much, as always. Our coverage on CNN continues right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.